All rights reserved. Do I have to spell it out? Except for reviews, written permission must be granted for all other forms of reproduction. Everything. No exceptions. Nader. And you can quote me on that. Passing Fancy is a work of fiction. All well-known actual people, events, and places that figure in the narrative are used fictitiously. All other names, characters, places, and occurrences are pure fabrication. If any living person believes they or anyone they know has been depicted in this narrative, I suggest they seek professional help immediately. All technical terms, foreign words and other esoterica are used with great precision, even when used erroneously. For example, there are many bowdlerized English, Latin and French terms used in the text, but I can't be held responsible for any such roué characters who, in finding themselves in the company of the unwashed, can't resist the urge to condescend. Regarding the esoterica, Lolita Punku. Lolita Punk was a 1990s niche fashion phenomenon in Japan, while L'Inconnu de la Seine, the unknown of the Seine, is a death mask of a young, Mona Lisa-like, drowning victim that inspired a proto-grunge look among women in the Weimar Republic. The citing and use of all historical events is merely the author's interpretation, and no claim to accuracy is made. The only good artist is a dead artist. Harry E. Smith. Art is anything you can get away with. Andrew Warhol. There are no mistakes in art, just happy little accidents. Bob Ross. A painting that does not shock is not worth painting. M. Duchamp. They don't care much for art in our war. Grant Wood. Art is knowledge made visible. G. Courbet. A painting is not made to be sniffed. Rembrandt van Rijn. The people who call my art abstract are imbeciles. C. Brancusi. Avant-garde is French for bullshit. John Lennon. An empty canvas is full. R. Rauschenberg. Silence is so accurate. M. Rocco. Silence remains, inescapably, a form of speech. Susan Sontag. It's not the bullet that kills you, it's the hole. Vito Acconci. In theatre, blood is ketchup. In performance art, everything is real. Marina Abramovic. I'm most embarrassed at my art shows, even though I don't show it. Ai Weiwei. My art is an exorcism, a guarantee of sanity. Louise Bourgeois. You shouldn't have to justify your art. Judy Chicago. If you have too many quotes from other people in your head, you can't create. Yoko Ono. What is said about art is most often too much. Debris. Pater. Internal monologue. 1.0 Blue painted in blue. 1.1 Thought bubbles. Dropping my lunchbox on the kitchen counter, I sank into a stool and punched the answering machine. I felt like I'd been in a 12-round fight that ended in a spectator brawl. God. That poor kid. 9x returned my call wanting confirmation of the job phone's cut-off date. Hell's wrong with him anyway? The plumber called to confirm for tomorrow. How could his mother let him go on howling all day like that? The electrician also confirmed he'd be there. That kid has relentless shrieks, drilling my head like an auger. Cheryl left a pretty annoying message. Hi baby, can't make it by 7. Sorry, 7:30, okay? Funny. Thought you should be home by now, just wanted to tell my hubby whoopee how much I whoop you. She blew a kiss into the phone. God, I hate baby talk. I punched the machine, punched it again clearing the messages. I especially hate it when lawyers use baby talk. I could just picture Cheryl negotiating contracts and fighting court battles. Judges and litigators alike reduced to putty as she spoon-fed them her gerber gobble. At least she hadn't cancelled, far too frequent an occurrence since becoming lead counsel on some sort of M&A swindle she's been on for the past 6 months. Right from the start, hasn't had time for anything, let alone an evening out with moi. I made a martini, damned it, and then made another. Wolfing down half a dozen olives, I restrained myself from making a snack. Hungry as I was, I wanted to save my appetite. I was really looking forward to tonight, especially after a day like today. God, that mother of his, love it when I can't remember the client's name, fuck was it? I made another drink, carried it with me to the shower. Right, Cynthia. What a woman. Craig, be a peach and change my bulb for me. Be a peach and move my boxes. Oh Craig, that's just peachy, what a whack job. 2 weeks to go, just 2 weeks left, and now, they suddenly have to move in. Showered, dressed, and still fooling with the same drink made earlier, I punched the remote just to have some background noise. Inadvertently switching on the VCR, a movie came on in mid-plot. Something vaguely familiar, Bette Davis and Leslie Howard, something Cheryl was in the middle of watching. I settled into my chair with a yawn. In a vindictive fit, Davis drags her mouth down the length of her arm. Spits, God, the way Cynthia was dressed in that get-up. Comes floating past, wearing this checkered jacket, lime over fuchsia stripes, that hideous blouse topping that dowdy skirt. Maroon tartan. What is she colorblind? Tartan and check, pattern blind too? No. Punk. That's it, not real punk, fashion punk. That swap of mascara ringing her eyes said it all. Caught me staring. She stops, plants her knuckles on her hips. I can't help but grin, too late to teach this girl how to dress. She asks me if I have a minute, wants me to move some boxes. I follow her into her bedroom. Sitting on the bed, dangling her feet in those little peep-toe kitten heels like that. Where else were my eyes going to go? She leans back on her elbows, telling me where to put the boxes, pointing with her toes. God. What a tease. Nevertheless I was a gentleman, wasn't I? Throwing a blanket over her when she fell asleep all sprawled out like that. A shriek, and the glint of a dagger drew me back to the TV. Grinning like a lunatic, Davis ransacks Leslie Howard's flat, gleefully slashing his paintings and drawings, going off on a tear destroying the contents of his studio. My kind of girl? The sound of the VCR woke me. Checking the time. I pulled myself together, and a half hour later I was sitting in Il Forno still stifling yawns. The 25-table restaurant was about half full, and Galina offered to seat me straight off, but I preferred waiting in the bar. Loretta Spadoro stepped up greeting me as only a Brooklyn girl could. Dehis, been on a trip? I shrugged dully, slipped her a 20. Didn't expect anything, just didn't feel like talking. Fact was, I was spent, almost fragile. The tip gave me a sense of security, like I had someone in my corner. Weaven Unbrian just aerated. Wisps of dimples fluttering her cheeks, she held up the decanter swirling the ruby liquid, niece knows, as the man says. Easy on the eyes, and always friendly, the Bumstonhurst beauty knew me well enough to know I usually drank wine. I knew her well enough to know the 20-something was trying to lose the accent. And had a laugh that could curdle milk. But what I especially liked about the 4-star Carcinitas Ghana was that they sold select wines by the glass. Unpretentious and a little hard scrabble, Il Forno was owned and operated by Sergio Forno and Galina Zareva. Among the last people who still knew me by my nom de guerre, Debris, I knew them from way back when they used to have a little gallery at 131 Worcester Saint, also called Il Forno. After the art market tanked in 86, no one was surprised when the buoyant Italian and Russian refugees from Soho landed in the restaurant business. The surprise was that they landed in Park Slope, bet they never thought they'd be priced out of Manhattan. Practically everyone working in the restaurant was a refugee from Manhattan, waitstaff, chefs, bartenders, dishwashers, all of them, actors, painters, musicians. Even a writer who mopped up at the end of the night. Loretta was a singer, supposed to be pretty good, obviously not good enough. More rearguard than avant-garde, the place had atmosphere. What was lacking was oxygen. Except for the handful of pieces hauled over from Manhattan by the bankrupt gallery owners, all the art on the walls was made by inept locals, save the bronze relief made by moi, hung in pride of place on the wall between the restrooms. Top to bottom, spanning the four directions, the walls were covered with transgressive art. That's what earned the place its nickname, Il Porno. Not that the art was smut, but just aberrant enough to generate a smug reference to Mayor Rex Pagata Giuliani and his gimcrack attack on the Brooklyn Museum. Between Loretta and the liquor bottles, it was no contest. I'd rather listen to her prattle on than be stuck waiting in the dining room staring at the art-rick walls. From the moment she'd set me up with a glass of wine, Loretta had been exercising her pipes, talking up some dismal movie called Four Weddings and a Funeral she'd seen in an exclusive preview earlier in the day. She described it in such excruciating detail I was thankful I'd never see it. Like I said, she's not hard to look at. Called the waiter to fill a drink order, I snagged the pad and pencil Loretta left on the bar, and doodled absently, abed, a prone figure, girlish, with a cherub's butt, she returned. I flipped the page. Catching her eye, drawing one ellipse atop another, I said, artist walks into a bar, and orders a draft beer. Two lines joined the ellipses, a little shading gave the cylinder dimension. Bartender says, sorry, we don't serve artists. Artist says, that's okay, I'll draw my own. I stood my sketch on the bar, a beer mug brimmed with froth running down the side. Loretta drifted off suffing. Don't tell me yours an artist too. Enticements wafting in from the dining room started to eat into my resolve to wait for Cheryl. Hitching a ride on the aroma, snippets of conversation drifted past. He used a club, not a cane, fresh pepper. Not Jeff Galuli, I'm talking about Michael Fay, you know, the kid in Singapore. More grisini please, piece of junk didn't stop them from stealing my car. Line of birth Fucci's far more evolved than Serrano. Serrano's had like three ideas his entire career. I just love my new shoes, don't you? Of course you can club someone with a cane, but what I'm talking about is more like a whip. Bet Cynthia cracks the whip. I could see her in those peep-toe kitten heels cracking the Ole Cat 09 tails on her husband. A real ball breaker, I bet. Already on my second glass, Sergio, an owner not too proud to wait table, stopped by to praise my choice of wine. Indeed, all the waiters stopped by to greet me, Enrico, Marco, Paula, Gina. Even Galina came by, interrupting my conversation with Sergio, offering a less formal greeting than given at the front door, at the same time telling me to slide my bar stool a bit further from the wait station. Turning to Sergio, she told her off-soused husband to stop talking so loud, jerked her thumb at me, and grunted, put some food in him while he waits for his wife. After scolding Loretta about being slow in filling drink orders, the unrelenting Russian stalked off. Sergio went off with a shrug, only to return moments later, practically pitching the plate at me. He said, Carpaccio. Leaning in with an easy intimacy I'd never tolerate if I hadn't already a few drinks in me, he took hold of the stem of my glass, sloshing the wine with a coarse finesse. The Umbrian, go with dish dish perfecto. Gusto, gusto. I knew what was going on here. Galina still hadn't forgiven me for that thing happened last December, when I forgot to cram something between the wine and my wits, when maybe I got a little too rowdy for her taste. I shrugged, and dug in. Dull, blank, happy, I dispatched the appetizer and glass of wine with as slow deliberation as three bites could endure. Sopping the remnants of the dish with bread, I sat there wondering what I'd actually say to Cheryl about my day, about that kid, about Cynthia. Propping chin on knuckles, I pictured the callow Leslie Howard as an upper crust fop, or maybe it was Hugh Grant, explaining the unexplainable. Darling, you wouldn't believe it, but today after the movers finished, funny thing really, the client bully ragged me into her bedroom to rearrange her boxes. Mind you dear, her boxes. Quite funny really, as moments before, she just happened to let drop that the old pan left her for lonely. Gone a good week. Then while I was slogging her rather bothersome boxes a to be, she fell into a sort of swoon, and let drop a snoot full of that other species of bothersome box one is more apt to sit upon. She actually fell asleep bottoms up, festooned as it were in tartan, an impudent thong afflicting her with a chronic wedgie. It was diabolical. I was trying to cook up a little chickety to tease Cheryl with, but it wasn't working. If anything, she'd be more inclined to scorn than any kind of titillation. Probably accuse me of being juvenile just for bringing it up. As I'd done earlier, I threw a blanket over it. Still, I couldn't dismiss the feeling that Cynthia maybe wasn't really asleep, that she was fake snoring, even though I knew she wasn't. But either way, I don't give a shit. I'm so often in the homes of women I barely know, stuck in seemingly compromising positions in closets, bathrooms, and bedrooms, just to tape measure between us. It often left me feeling like a eunuch enduring the half-dressed traits of the harem. Draining my glass, I tore into the bruschetta Sergio had just set in front of me. God damn it, Cheryl, where the hell are you? 4 shots of please, cramming the entire wad in my mouth, I looked longingly over my shoulder through the plate glass facade. More water. The inchoate drift of the diner's chatter making me more lonesome. You haven't seen the Cairn Mutiny, really? Yeah, crossing the bridge in a van, they just shot them. We ought to cane our graffiti artists, not for vandalism, but for lack of ideas. What's his name? Jose Ferrer. He played that lawyer. Having a lawyer for a wife, not something I'd recommend. It's a rationed relationship in which the wife is also wed to her firm, and at never under a 12-hour day, as far as Temer shares go, it's a pretty iffy 50 deal. Hers is an absolutely scheduled life, every burp and fart logged to accounts billable. They'd pretty much only let me have her when she's sleeping. I'd like my salad as a starter, please. If not for Saturday morning sex on the docket, I don't know what we'd have. I feel like something sweet, staring over my shoulder out the window didn't get me anything. God damn it, Cheryl. We just got back from Munich where we saw Nirvana at Terminal 1. Hasidic Jews are convenient targets for hate. Are there any other kinds of Jews? I wish I never cut my hair. I wished I hadn't told Loretta that joke. I wished I had another appetizer. I wished I hadn't seen Cynthia lying on the bed like that. For the second time I'd sketched it out on the pad in jumbled tableau. Legs crossed, leaning back propped on elbows, flat on her back, lying on her side. That pert little cherub's butt. I started shading it for dimension. On the page it looked all right, but that didn't stop me from seeing it as a series of awkward moments frozen in time. In any case, the incident didn't have the makings of an erotic amuse-bouche to tease Cheryl with. Roger, you're rambling again. Check please, 4 Egyptians on trial for the World Trade Center bombing, and 4 Jews shot. Will that be all? Did you know Kurt Cobain's worn the same sweater for the past 5 years? Roger, I never said you were selfish, I said you were cheap. Sergio dropped a dish of calamari with red pepper sauce in front of me. Lurit, pour the cavaniolo, tart, voluptuous, will send dish aloft. I shoveled a forkful of squid in my mouth. Chewed. How dare Cheryl bring up selling my loft again? Jesus, that's spicy. Guess I started it though. I poked the red bird peppers with my fork, slurped the wine, crammed in more calamari, and washed it down with more wine. Complaining about her work schedule always starts it. Cheryl never liked the loft, been trying to talk me into a house since we married. But this wasn't about the loft, it was about moving on. Moving past the failed artist stage of life, dumping the loft and packing up all the untidy fragments of a faith forgotten. But I didn't want to move on. I was the contractor with the secret life. I had a secret self who felt he was always on the verge of picking up the tools and sculpting again. How could I move into a house? Gobbling down the appetizer without tasting anything but the burn, I drained my glass. Slammed it on the bar. I couldn't picture myself without my loft, because even a failed artist is still an artist. Sure, I know what's her face is no longer using, but you should have seen her back then. She used to crawl. We're meeting at Bridge Space. I don't know, it's kind of like having your mouth washed out with soap. All that hermeneutics of hermeneutic stuff. It basically leaves St. Ag's critique of criticism more pompous than the very criticism underlying her critique. I got up to pee. Outside the restroom, I paused to admire my work. A smaller version of a piece that could be seen in the Brooklyn Museum, part of my manhole cover series, Escape Velocity. An early piece, three deformed manhole covers appear to erupt from the wall. I ran my fingers over the surface, still feeling the latent heat of the molten bronze. The patination gorgeous, the composition superb, the detail in the rendering refined. It's not my art, but the art world that's substandard. In this findicical world of commerce, the only real talent an artist needs is the talent to convince others that they possess a limitless talent. That leaves me, a man of limitless talent, left wandering in an inelegant wasteland of imposter, assaults and fraud. My crime is simple. I did not die young, like Haring or Basquiat. Nevertheless, I pushed into the men's room confident that no matter what the world now thinks of my shit, I am at the very least Gil Miglia for bro. Back at the bar, Loretta refilled my glass. It might have been vinegar for all I cared. Cheryl was nowhere in sight. I knew what was going on. This wasn't the first time you got to see his show. Not only has Reward appropriated Matt Clark, but he has succeeded in extending the vocabulary. Honesty is unbecoming a drunkardy, so please shut up. Last week it was Callista Flockhart, this week it's Claire Danes. Man, all the women you're attracted to got no ass, they're all like orexia. I gazed at the little tableau of headless figures in my sketch, tore it from the pad and crumpled the page against my forehead. I threw the pencil across the room, crossing my arms in abject refusal. My mother was so angry that she duct-taped a pair of DeWitt graphite tint sticks, one to each hand. Christ, I was like 8 years old. I wanted to draw aliens and monsters, rockets and ray guns, but she tore all those up. My hands had gone numb from being forced to draw the same reclining figure first with one hand and then the other. I could still see the poses. Sitting on the edge of the bed, legs crossed, 2 minutes. Leaning back on elbows, knees pressed together, 2 minutes. Lying on her side with her knees drawn up, 2 minutes. Lying on her stomach, an arm turned back, draped across her buttocks, 2 minutes. Lying flat on her back, feet angling over the edge, I caught my breath and uncrumpled the paper. The headless figures I'd drawn weren't of Cynthia. They were the figure studies forced on me by my mother. The same relentless studies she had me doing since I could hold a pencil. The same poses she modeled for me every day until I drained my glass, picked up the pencil with a twitch, fixed a stare on Loretta, and sketched furiously. In a few moments I got a pretty good likeness down, shading and detailing as she stood showing me her profile, ringing up receipts, yakking on the phone, and working the length of the bar tending drink orders. The restaurant door banged open, and a party of 12 entered loud and exuberant. A train wreck rolling over the hostess station, the newcomers were so boisterous all four waiters rushed in, joining Galina and Sergio in herding the crowd into the bar as diners and drinkers glared New York aplomb, or rubbernecked with Jersey gusto. A tap on my shoulder drew me back around to the bar. And Loretta leaned in, pressing her broad cleavage in my face, husking in my ear. Cherry cooled, said she can't make it, so go ahead, eat without hunger. Dazed by the aroma of sweet sweat, I toggled my eyes between the man's as a translation slowly stitched together. I took in another snoot full of her scent, feeling sublimely settled on exactly nothing. Yeah, I was pretty wasted. Slowly excavating schnoz from the décolletage, scaling full red lips, I smiled into her livid puce eyes. Said to say, she'll see yours at home, soon as she can. Petting my cheek, Loretta showed me a pout. Poor baby, that don't sound too promising. Hey Loretta, thumb over my shoulder, what's with the cattle call? Like I need this, Loretta leaned in giving me another snoot full. Tapping a nail on the sketch, I want this picture of me, kay? She brimmed my glass with the cruet, and turned to deal with a trio of ogling dorks crying for beer. Watching the rubbernesque bartender work, I turned the page, and began outlining head, torso, breasts, hips, thighs, eyes, lips. Working my pencil, an acute sense of the feminine presence before me enlarged as the swirl in restaurant and bar receded. 20 minutes of that, I flopped back in the stool pining for my wife. I mean, Loretta is sexy as all get out, But I was tired of the Bumsnhurst naive and her too big everything. Enough. Besides, these jerks in the bar were way too bumptious. I wanted my check. I wanted to go home to my Cheryl. Sergio swooped in with a bowl, linguine with fresh grilled sardines. Sorry, Serg, you have a chance, need my check. I bent my chin over my shoulder as another group surged in through the door. What's going on? St. Patrick's Day come early this year? Is opening after party. He blew air through his lips and went to herd the new stragglers out of the dining room. The crowd packing the bar was flying off in all directions, bouncing back to street, blocking the entrance, shuttling between bar and bathroom in nattering nose-wiping groups, while some clod strolled the restaurant like a beggar, mutely placing postcard invitations on the tables of the diners, until finally being shooed out by Galina. Up and down the aisles the patrons were calling for checks, stabbing cigarettes in uneaten food, losing patience, groping after scrambling waiters. Apology and excuse bounding the room, drinks and desserts were comped for those in less of a hurry to desert their tables. Wolfing down my linguine, anxious to join the exodus, I was momentarily distracted by the appearance of a pastry spiked with fresh raspberries floating in molten chocolate, the Amazer Cafe an added enticement steaming by its side. Tucking into the confection, tweening sips of the grappa-infused espresso endowed me with a sort of subdued impatience as the waiters dispatched the more agitated among the diners. The last seating dwindled to nothing, and I killed the coffee watching the staff arrange a row of four tops down the center of the room. Sergio placed my check on the bar, and as a coup de grace, tipped a bottle of Nardini Bianco over my demitasse, brimming it with a flourish before I could refuse. He breezed off humming Nell Blue to Bind to Die Blue. Check paid, demitasse drained, I stood up so thoroughly content, I could barely stand to leave. Let down by Cheryl, I looked longingly at Clarissa, wondering if I could induce her to have sex with me. I thought $100 might do it, but then again, honesty unbecoming a drunk, I decided on the better part of valor, and instead signed my drawing of the bartender. Still, I clung to the bar aching to say goodnight to the Bumsnhurst beauty, but she was just one more working girl with no time for me. I took my watch off, tucking it under the sketch because it was high time I left before I said something I might regret. Making for the exit, some guy from the after party cut me off at the door, pressing an invitation at me. Just soused enough, I stopped, took the postcard and read aloud, "The Sandyke Gallery presents Kitchen Debris, Installation and Appropriation by Craig Dibro." My head lolled back, and I howled, "Debris by Dibro? What is this? The artistic half-life of half-wits. Artists are such assholes." With a bloated understanding that no two bodies may occupy the same point in space, artists strike a pose, perch on an angle, squat on an idea, and then proceed to homestead the concept in an all-out effort to grandfather a common tract of knowledge as their own. Having staked their claim, they defend the territory as if it were actually a vision unique to the world. The contemporary artist's sole discovery has been that they occupy a distinctly useless point in postmodernism's endless aesthetic continuum. My only wish is that these artists who make such a show of rejecting the very notion of art in their art, would just sit down. Or they're offering as a self-cancelling conceptualism, really, why bother? I heard it said somewheres, honesty is unbecoming drunk, so I thought maybe a little truth-telling might sober me up. Hiking up my pants, I sauntered up to the table addressing the near end. Who's the show? The guy with debris? Several people pointed to the pinhead squaring up a stack of invitations on the table. Too pie-eyed to put the brakes on now, I tapped the top postcard. Shouldn't appropriation come before the installation? Doesn't the thief steal before he stashes? Oh, please. The artist installed himself at the head of the table, showed me his shoulder, and sulked. Inspired by the brooding artist, I grabbed a fistful of postcards, and springing them from hand to hand, I cut the deck shouting, "Voila! I show you appropriation." Raising arms high overhead, I shot the cards, 52 pickup, showering the people around the table with invitations. "I give you installation." "Voila" out. People were crowding me, jostling and grunting untranslatable obscenities. I wasn't so insensible that I didn't note a couple people laughing, and, ignoring the anger, I sidled toward the smiles. Maybe they wanted to buy me a drink. Sergio stepped in, laying a hand on my shoulder. Okay, debris, is enough for tonight. Sergio and Marco each caught an arm steering me toward the bar. Another drink seemed like a good idea. Surprised at finding myself so suddenly standing on the sidewalk, I braced against chill, struggling to match the two sides of my coat's zipper. Gazing at my reflection in the restaurant window, the bright tutu reflection of my grin seemed to occlude my face as I said, I saw a hollow stone and I couldn't just let it lie. I mean, I have a reputation to maintain here. 1.2 a quart of milk. Landing in my neighborhood, scouring the streets between the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges for a place to park, I found a spot on Water Street overlooking the East River, and sat there taking in the dank view, and nursing a foul mood. Manhattan cut a dark chiaroscuro in the thick haze as I ran my eyes over the skyline, feeling like a dope, a dupe, and a doofus, wondering how it was possible I once believed this Babylon on Hudson, this Gomorrah between the rivers, was the cultural center of the universe. What a sham, a scam, an utterly filthy joke. There's no culture in New York, it's all couture. I got out of my car, slamming the door. The city across the river no longer held out any hopes for me, no dream of accomplishment, no fantasy of fulfillment. Our romance was over. Across the East River, the swarm of news helicopters sniffing out the next disaster were like so many flies circling a steaming pile of shit. Crossing the shadows in the canyon between the bridges, I turned toward the loft on Plymouth Street. The stretch of blocks known as Dumbo is always fairly deserted at this time of night, the remaining factories not yet overtaken by lofts had disgorged their workers hours ago, while the local loft dwellers were homebound prisoners of the neighborhood blight. The cheap amber glow of the mercury vapor lights gave the streetscape an unhealthy glow, the sidewalks looked like jaundiced skin, the cobblestones like bad teeth. Passing a loading dock, I glanced at the woman dumpster diving and quickened my step. This was not a street for the faint of heart. Carol, my ex, was right about one thing: if we'd lived in Brooklyn back in the day, Warhol never would have visited my studio. Coming from Boston, I was unaware of the condescension until I moved to Brooklyn, but no one who lives in Manhattan willingly crosses the East River. Approaching my building, key in hand, I hurried up to my door, stabbing it into the lock. Not quick enough. There was an urgent tapping on my shoulder, and I turned to meet the vapid gaze of my high-strung top-floor neighbor, Helen Dew, who I'd seen dumpster diving by the loading dock. Before I could head her off, she said, I hear you selling loft. Where did you get this little pearl? Little pearl? Cherry. She just wants to find out what you'll pay. How much you want? Well, Helen, there you go. If you don't make me an offer, how can I turn you down? I don't want you to turn me down. Then don't make me an offer. Come on, why not let somebody else have space going to use it? That really frosted me. Unable to think of a suitable response, my hand twitched the key and I swung open the door. Taking advantage of my distraction, Helen pushed her way in, and running a lustful eye from ceiling to floor, she bellowed, "Whoa! All this waste space. Every time I see, gets bigger." It was easy to see why people referred to the pushy performance artist as a Lin Hu. Helen, I'm warning you, she knew I didn't like her, but she didn't care who liked her. Why else would the jail graduate with the mid-Atlantic accent constantly assault friend and stranger alike with her faux Sino-Japanese accent? Sure, I slept with Dollface once, between Carol and Cheryl, and she's been making me regret it ever since. You should use this as performance space. Helen, don't be a pest, I said with threadbare restraint. I still couldn't get that chicken feather, marshmallow fluff and blood-soaked performance piece she'd done in Calvary Cemetery some years back out of my head. Helen, I hate to break it to you, but a plot is not a patch of turf in which to bury the story. But then again, that's probably why suicide is considered the pinnacle of all performance art. I mean, Who could criticize you after you accomplish that? How about it, Helen? Got a suicide piece in your oeuvre you plan on performing anytime soon, like tonight maybe? You know, Daybury, you really such a soul. I am not the one who came crawling in, trying to cut a real estate deal. Your wife approached me. I am sure Cheryl did not. Ask her. She mentioned this morning. Goodbye, Miss Sue. I drew up my bulk, not for sale. Not for you, not for V, not for fucking XYZ. Now get lost. Ask Cheryl, she said, backing out the door looking a little rattled. Ask her. I intend to. Slamming the door in her face, now doubly pissed because I'd answered her. She was right, of course, on both counts. Cheryl wanted me to sell the loft, and I am an asshole, but God, what a buzzkill. I kicked a bundle of 2x4s stupidly left standing upright against the wall. They toppled over in a clattering heap, scoring half a dozen arcs in the paint as they took out several works on paper. Shucking my coat, I dashed it to the floor, shouting what I wished I'd said. Helen, I'll burn this place to the ground before I'll sell it to you. To look at the vast studio that greeted me was to behold the festering carcass of my muse. Stalking across the room, clawing at my chest, I ripped open my shirt, wishing it were my skin. Snatching up a lighter, I lit a pile of papers on fire. Watching the flames grow, I sneered through the gash in my soul. Helen, making art is easy. Try making sense, that's the trick. The smell of the dank smoke rising from the flames was invigorating, the thought of becoming ash liberating. I'd rather die than sell this place. One of the nicest lofts in the city, my studio was profiled a few years back in the home section of the Times, and duly proclaimed one of the nicest artist lofts in New York City. With its soaring 20-foot ceiling, the 6,000-square-foot street-level space was ideal for a sculptor. The living space at the back is nestled in a 2,000-square-foot overlooking the studio like an Anasazi cliff dwelling. The studio is outfitted with top-notch equipment, a couple of trip hammers, a 100-weight tail helve, a quarter-ton belly helve, winches, lifts, torches, planishers, slab rollers, kilns, grinders, a small forge, acid baths for patination, state-of-the-art ventilation. All the tools I could ever need. Around the space, except where hand tools hung, the walls were covered with drawings and assorted clay and plaster maquettes in various stages of completion. Several dozen finished works in bronze relief hung on the walls, larger objects standing in the round-filled nook and niche, while smaller objects d'art covered the shelves, sills and ledges built for the purpose. On the surface, that is, what could actually be seen amid 7 years of accumulated junk, it appeared to be a fairly prodigious output, but my best work was behind me, done before I moved here. Sure, I've made hundreds of drawings and models since moving here, but nothing's been cast since 87, the bleakest year. It's as though I went out for a walk one day, and was last seen on the back panel of a quart of milk. Hefting up a plaster bust of Larry Rivers, I hurled it discus style across the room. Hitting the wall, a satisfying cloud of white blossomed in midair as debris rained over the floor. People used to know me as Debris, my nom de guerre, a pun on my grandmother's maiden name, which was Debris. A clever moniker for a sculptor, I thought. Now everyone calls me Craig, my given name, Crag, a steep cliff, a big uncarved block, something you fall off, like the height of my career. Starting in 85 with the sudden surge in AIDS, I watched dozens of friends and colleagues being picked off one by one. With the death of Bethel Park, the Park Place Gallery closed, and there were no shows. With no shows, there were no sales. And with everything perfectly timed to coincide with the art market crash, the shit just piled up. The debris of debris. I woke up one day and everyone of any importance to me was dead. Bronze and plaster, bones and ash, the debris of debris. Renewal always follows loss, and weary of the mourning process, I pressed on. After completing this studio late in 88, I got back to work, but somehow the spell was broken. I can't blame it all on death. I'm certainly not the first artist to experience catastrophic loss. Something else went wrong. Maybe it's just bad feng shui, but with the expansion, as if repulsed by the shiny and new, my mojo vanished. What seemed like a good idea at the time was in fact an idea whose time had passed. This loft would have been perfect for me 10 years before I moved in, but it's completely wrong now. Wrong for the artist who is only occasionally working on paper. Wrong for the married guy. Wrong for the working stiff, impossible to subdivide and sublet. It's even wrong for a building contractor's storage shed. For the past 7 years, this studio has been nothing but a dumping ground, a landfill sinking under the accumulated leftovers from construction work. Everywhere the debris of debris. It was with intentional irony I took the moniker, as I did envision once I was dead and gone, the remains of my studio should become a grave Lanoguchi, the museum of debris. But as an enduring epitaph, this rabble doesn't add up to anything more than a filthy hall shrine to failure. The smoke filling the studio cut at my nose, and I called out my wife's name. I couldn't help hoping, but she wasn't home, be lucky to see her before midnight. Making my way across the studio to the stairs at the back, I heard the sound I'd been expecting. The ventilation system finally caught a big enough whiff, and kicked in scrubbing the air, as the fire I'd set in one of the kilns now routinely used as a trash incinerator smoldered. As attractive as the idea was, for one living in a fireproof building with a state-of-the-art fire suppression system, flame was not likely to be the agent of my liberation. At the foot of the stairs I snicked on the lights and went up. I've long considered building a hallway across a room, joining the entry to the back stairs just so I wouldn't have to look at my studio. That's just how wrong it is. The living space should have been built at the front of the building, and the studio at the back. That's just how wrong it is.